I was coming from Montgomery. I had my guitar on my back. When this stranger stopped beside me in an antique Cadillac. He was dressed like 1950, half drunk and hollow-eyed. Say, it's a long walk to Nashville, would you like to ride? I sat down in the front seat, turned on the radio. Them sad old songs coming out of them speakers was solid country gold. Then I noticed the stranger was ghost white pale when I asked him for a light. I knew there was something strange about this ride. He said, "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you're playing sign? Have you paid your dues? Can you moan the blues? Can you bend them guitar strings? Boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride."
Hello and welcome to Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly. My name is Victor Sosa, joined, as always, by the Nick-Nick-wearing birthday boy himself, Mr. Les Thatcher, and, of course, a special guest run-in from the man from whom this show is named. The great Doc Young is with us as well this morning. And, Doctor, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right. I appreciate the great part. What it probably means is great pain in the ass, but... Yeah,
I'll give you all those accolades when we bury you. How's that? That's you save all the fancy shit for when we pass away, right? That's I'll find there'll be people liking me that never liked me at all when I'm dead. So.
Exactly.
What's up, Doc? And I don't mean that to sound like.
Well, I had to come on the show this week. I had to come on the show this week because, obviously, it is, as you know, if you hang around the board, if you know Les, it is Les's birthday week, and we can't let that go. 74 years old.
We could let the birthday thing go. I'm going to start going backwards in years instead of forward, I think.
You could, do that Benjamin Button type thing.
Yeah,
you hit 74, and then next year you're 73. You're 72, and
although there's hope, we'll talk about this later. But I, you know, a longtime friend and mentor of mine, Bob Geigel, passed away at 90. And I didn't realize that he was having a problem with Alzheimer's. But because I was just saying to Vic that I saw him, not this past CAC, but the year before in Vegas, and he seemed good, you know. Anyway, so he was 90. Ox was 80. So I've got a couple more years left, I guess. I don't know.
You've got plenty, my friend. You're one of the healthiest mid-70s guy I know.
I gotta jump some weight though. Vic is gonna be in this amazing shape, and then next time I see him, I'll look like his before picture or something. So,
no, I was telling somebody the other day, you know, I'm lifting heavy and eating heavier, so kind of undoing all the good we do in the gym.
I got you. So, Doctor, what's your take on? I'm not sure on what. who's the new love of your life?
It's still Paige.
Oh, okay.
I have not given up on her.
Are you frenemies? Is that what she calls them?
Yes, frenemies, okay. Yeah.
Well, I hope not. She was in Indianapolis not too long ago and did not come to visit me, so I was a little disappointed at that.
I can understand that. So you want to talk about your... involved in as a executive producer in some movies or something, right?
Oh God! Right now, it kind of explains why I'm going to bed right now. And
okay.
All these projects just they take their toll mentally, and then I have you know, the physical tolls that I'm going through. But, you know, I'm still booking for Brian.
Right.
You know,
and, it, and you're still trying to hustle the nurses, right? And stuff.
Oh, absolutely. It,
okay,
yeah, it depends
on as long as you're active, I know. The one movie I know, when I saw the name of it, Jersey Shore Massacre, I just thought it was a bad Raw, but then you told me it was actually a movie.
It's actually a movie, yeah. And I'll get you guys some copies, and maybe you can take a look at it, and you can discuss
well,
it on the show next week.
One of the WWE guys is in this thing, right, this Jersey Shore Massacre?
Right, Romeo Rosselli from the Heartthrobs. He has
Antonio Thomas'
pretty,
partner, sure.
Yeah, he has a really big meaty role in this movie.
You know what? Let me interrupt you one more time here. It's the last time I was up for Antonio doing a camp. They had a show on Saturday night, and Romeo was there, and he and Antonio worked as a team. But the thing was, after he had left, I said to Antonio, I said, "Damn, we had met before," and he hadn't remembered. I didn't, but you know, and I didn't until after the fact. That was at your show in Indiana, where Rosie and I came down from Cincinnati for it. He was on that show, right?
Yeah, that was the first time I had met Romeo. Now, I remember Romeo came in the show, and he wanted to get paid in advance, which I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to pay everybody, like, an intermission. I figured that was going to be my thing. But he came in, he wanted to get paid right away, and there was this whole misunderstanding where there was this show going on about 4 or 5 hours away, where they were claiming that he was going to be wrestling for them that night. And I said something jokingly, like, "You're not going to take my money and run off with it, are you?" He's like, "No, I wouldn't do that." So I give him I give him pneumonia or whatever, and he went to that steakhouse right there by the menu. I don't know if you and Rosie went there or not, but it was called Montana Mike's, and he just he went in there, and he had big old steak, had a really nice big dinner, and I don't know if he blew his whole salary on that dinner or not, but
I was about to say if you picked up the tab, then I am upset that Rosie and I didn't go to the damn steakhouse.
No, he sat there at that huge meal, and then he came out and wrestled. So
you've got to send Vic a copy of that particular show. It was chuckles. I mean, there were three guys that could actually work on the show. Rosie, Romeo, and the what was the kid's name, Doc, that was getting ready to go to developmental?
Robert Anthony.
Yeah, who went.
He wrestles more as egotistical fantastico under a mask.
Yeah, but anyway, those three guys, and Doc, also, there was a guy, Vic, that it looked like they'd thrown Undertaker in a dryer and he shrunk.
Oh no!
I mean, I thought it was Halloween. I thought it was a rib. The guy couldn't have been more than 5'1". I don't think 5'2" at the most, and had the whole.
Oh, the manager guy.
Yeah.
Oh well, not only was he that short, but he was about 60-something, if I remember correctly.
He was what?
He was in his 60s, I believe.
I don't know what his age was. I don't have a clue. But I just thought, oh, wow. Anyway, that was...
Yeah, we put together a motley crew for that show. But, you know, it was called No Second Chances, you know. And it didn't earn one.
And the picture, Vic, if you saw the picture Doc posted for my birthday, of him and I?
I did, yes.
Yeah, that was taken at that show.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. So back to the movie, yeah.
Back to the movie.
Romeo is in that movie, and the thing that I'm dealing with right now is that I'm attached to about three different movies right now. Just got done filming. It's going to be a big race to see which ones come out first, or at the same, or are they going to come out at the same time? And you know, I'm going to be doing publicity for, you know, all three of them. But we just wrapped last week of another sort of wrestling related movie. This one's called Toxic Tutu.
Called what?
And you gotta hear it out. Are you aware? Do you know anything about the Toxic Avenger?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay,
is
this
that, is a book or something.
It was a cult movie from the '80s.
Oh, okay.
Real gory and real weird, but yeah. It's kind of like that. It's a mockumentary about the boy who plays the character Melvin the Mop Boy, who is the guy that gets all the toxic waste on him, becomes the Toxic Avenger. So, so the movie is about the actor. His name is Mark Torgel. He comes out of seclusion for 30 years, which is not a storyline. He really has nobody who's really known where he's been for 30 years. So he comes out and he's doing the conventions, a year-long conventions. Now, in the movie, while he's doing the conventions, all sorts of strange stories get out. Strange things start to happen. And it gets worse and worse and, you know, possibly deadly. And you'll just have to see the movie to see what happens. Johnny Fairplay is in this movie, playing himself, but kind of an evil Johnny Fairplay of himself. And also doing a cameo with Jake the Snake Roberts, who came and shot the scene and looks like $1 million. And also doing a cameo on screen is the producer and founder of a podcast named Wrestling Weasley. His name's Doc Young.
And you bookers and promoters always get yourselves over, don't you? I mean, I don't know what to think.
He will be making a cameo in this movie, so you gotta check that out. It's coming out.
You get the girl when you make the cameo. Do you get the girl?
I'm not at liberty to.
Oh,
he's signed a confidentiality agreement.
Yeah, right.
I actually, no bullshit, 100%, I did sign a confidentiality
no
agreement.
Kidding.
No kidding.
Well, there are things up at the Academy Award presentations, I'm supposed
right. to. There are things I seriously do not talk about. But yeah, I just wanted to get those out there and let you guys know about that. But yeah, the more I talk these days, you know, the more it's wearing me out because I'm not used to talking so much. I could go all day, you know, around here without talking more than 5 minutes total, you know.
Well, then you were saying that you're getting ready to go to bed anyway, right?
Yeah, I am. I'm ready to, you know, conk out. I've been just doing work all night. I've been, trying to book the next month for Brian and, just doing some stuff for some of the movies. Now, I was just, for the Toxic Tutu, it was just supposed to be me doing a cameo in it. But, I kept bugging the director so much, with this idea and that idea. And so he's finally like, you know what, we're going to make you associate producer. And I was like, okay. Cause I really kind of wanted to be just the cameo. Cause I didn't want to look like I got to be in the movie just cause I was the producer. But when somebody offers you the title of producer, you don't say no. So, I may have to have everybody think that.
Well, it's like some bookers book themselves on top. It's okay,
right.
Not. It's politics. We understand that. This is the wrestling we're talking about.
And I know I don't have a lot about wrestling to talk about this week because I've been missing out on a lot of it, but I'm still there for Paige whenever she needs me. It's facebook.com/DocYoung. You can get a hold of me anytime, day or night, hon. Whatever you need, I'm there for you.
I don't know what kind of medication they're giving you, but send me some. I want to get on the same buzz. I swear I do.
This is going to be a free show, of course, today. So I got to do my pitch for Brian. Everybody, you got to sign up for the newsletter. You obviously get the Observer from Dave Meltzer's side. You get the Figure Four Daily Figure Four Weekly. From Brian Alvarez's side, you got the board, many wonderful characters and people all over the board. And you know what? Everybody else on the internet, they get their news from this site anyway. So you might as well come here and get the news here first. Guys, I love you.
I'm aware of all the caring, wonderful, sensitive people on the board.
Yes, they're fully, they love wrestling.
Yeah,
they're fully committed. Les, happy birthday, my friend. I could not come on today on your birthday week. I could not miss it. Happy 74th. I love you.
I love you, and
Vic.
Yes, sir.
You keep doing the best show that you can, man. And you guys, you keep on keeping on. Everybody out there, the listeners, I love you for being there for Les and being there for Vic. And, hey guys, if you want to catch me, facebook.com/DocYoung. And you can follow my exploits. But, it's my bedtime, guys. I'm out of here.
It's philandering and
nurse chasing.
Woman chasing, yes. They can follow that one.
Absolutely. Good night, guys.
Hey.
Good night, Doc.
Love you, Doc. You take and sleep tight, okay, buddy?
That is the leader of this fine wrestling program, which has existed in some shape, form, or fashion less since when? When was the first time you and Doc did a show together?
Oh, my God. I don't know how many years ago. He's been ill for the last... How long have you and I been doing this show?
Gosh, going on, was it 3-4 years now?
Yeah, and so he's, we won best podcast show, I'm not even sure what year it was, Vic, but for those who don't know, Doc has been fighting this, I can't even think of the name of the illness, anyway, it's where the body starts to eat its own immune system. And when he thought it was a head cold and thought it was just coughs, and we were going to take some time off because he was constantly coughing. And that's been, my God, Vic, that's been 8 years, 9 years ago almost, and he's been fighting this thing ever since. We came back, he thought he was going to be able to come back, and he did for a little bit. And then Will Strauss came on and helped out, and then you and I, and then it's been you and I ever since. So, Lord, I don't know how many years we go back. I think we first did our first show together probably 2004 or 5, I guess.
And for the uninitiated, it's been on the Observer website for the last several years, at least a year or so predating our getting together, so probably 5 years at least at this point. But it originally started on an actual radio station in your area.
Yeah, yeah. But he's, you know, he sounds better now than, I mean, in other words, he's able to get through this without coughing, you know, but, yeah, it's, talk about a fighter. Doc is that. There's no two ways about it. And I pick on him and tease him all the time, but God love him. He's pound for pound tougher than I'll ever be. I mean, he's been fighting this thing for so long. Anyway, so what do we got for today, Victor?
Well, before we move into the meat of the discussion today, which is going to include a little bit on the WWE Network numbers, just a couple of things, not too much, because obviously Dave and Brian, if you've had a chance to visit the Observer website in the last few days, have covered that thing from top to bottom, and some great audio yesterday with good old JR, Jim Ross, breaking those numbers down as well. Talk a little bit about the Billy Jack lawsuit, but perhaps from a different perspective, since that's been in the news recently, and lots of questions, as a matter of fact, from folks on Facebook, Twitter, and the board that we have to tackle. But first, I want to hear all about this fabulous birthday present you received this week.
I got a package, and I couldn't think what the hell is in this package. And it was a Nick shirt. Now, where the hell she got that? Some thrift shop somewhere, I suppose. But believe it or not, it was one of the, well, as we talked about, we're going to make these shirts infamous all over again, I guess. They were limited production. In other words, one bolt of material in a certain pattern. Once that bolt was gone, that pattern was gone. So it wasn't like you were going to see six guys with the same shirt that you had on. And that's one of the reasons for the cost. A, they were made in Italy. B, because of the limited patterns, these things were $30-$35 bucks a pop back in the early 70s. And at the time, I was young and a clothes horse. So anyway, Alice was able to come up with one of these things and sent it to me for my birthday, and I do appreciate it. It's hanging in my closet. I may try to lose a little weight to get into it, but I can't narrow my shoulder girdle down. That's one thing I can't do. But anyway, Alice, if you're I do appreciate it. It's a great gift, and I didn't know you could find these things anymore, I swear. But so yeah, that was you know, the amazing thing. Doc mentioned Facebook, and I know we're all on it. I got, it was over at this point, and counting the belated birthday wishes, I got over 700 birthday wishes on that thing from Spain, Japan, England, Israel, Canada, and all over the country, and maybe some countries that I'm not aware of. But that's just amazing, you know, and for anybody listening, I sure appreciate it. I do.
700 countries, but only one Nick shirt.
Yeah. and it is, like I say, it has a prominent place in my closet. Even if I can't wear it, I would not part with it.
But you know, all it's going to take, we talked about bodybuilding. We got a lot of questions about your days as a bodybuilder and training bodybuilders. You know, all it would probably take is like a couple of weeks worth of a competition diet.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, or starving myself at this age. My metabolism was never great when I was younger and competing, and it's certainly not great now. Yeah, I honestly want to lose a few pounds. I do, and I'm going to make that attempt. But I don't know if I'll ever fit into the shirt. Could always cut the sleeves out, couldn't I?
Hey, you know what? Display the guns. That would be even better in the nightclub with the fabulous Nick shirt, and it's the gun show in the nightclub. I love it.
Oh my God. I'm too old for this craziness. Anyway.
It would be fantastic. Now I got to see that.
Yeah, I heard you. I heard you. Do we start with Bob Geigel?
You know what? Let's do that.
Yeah. I just found out this morning that Giggs had passed away. Bob Geigel was a hell of a guy. A legitimate badass, I mean, shooter. Wrestled in Iowa. So if you wrestled in Iowa, you pretty much had to be, you know, that was some the cream of the amateur crop for many, many years, along with Oklahoma. But anyway, I remember buying tickets to watch Bob Geigel when I was a kid, you know, when I was 9, 10, 11 years old. He began the business, as I read this morning, in 1950. Anyway, so I was honored and blessed to be able to work with Bob in 1963. I went to the Kansas City Territory, and Bob was one of the owners, along with Pat O'Connor and Gus Karras. And I had the opportunity to get to know Bob and to work. Bob was just, you know, he was a laid-back guy. He'd see him shuffling down the street from the Kansas City and Hotel where the wrestling office was in KC. Flip-flops and jeans and a tee. I mean, he was no pretense with Bob at all. Just one of the boys. Laid back, good guy. I remember the first time I was booked to work with him, I was a bit nervous because, you know, first of all, he's the boss. Second of all, he's one of the guys I bought tickets to see as a kid. Amazing worker. There's an expression in the business called a night off, and with Bob, it was always a night off. What was so amazing to me, obviously, as a young guy, too, here's one of the owners of the territory, and I'm going to work with him, and I don't remember what the first time, what town it was in. I think it was a spot show, and he actually rode with me, and anyway, we went three falls, and he made me look like $1 million, and as I said on Facebook, I never walked away from a time in the ring with him, but I didn't think I became a better worker, a better wrestler for it. He was a good guy, class act, hell of a worker. I saw him, last time I saw him was in Vegas at CAC. That was 2 years ago. I was, when I saw this morning that he, you know, had Alzheimer's, that wasn't apparent back then. You know, Bob was, he had that bow-legged walk of his. I could, that, where his butt was, I mean, a lot of us, you know, you hear the people talking about doing Jim Barnett impersonations and Stu Hart. Well, it was guys that walked like Bob Geigel. Always had a smile and a good word. Les, how are you? I'm good, Bob. How about you? And so forth and so on. So anyway, you know, I think, you know, it was an honor to work with him and to know him. And, you know, my condolences and heartfelt, sincere, you know, feelings go out to the family. A lot of love and respect for this guy. He was a hell of a worker, and the NWA president, too.
That's right. That's where folks of my generation would have recognized him long after his days in the ring were over. He was the president of the National Wrestling Alliance, and you'd often see him sending in videos, especially for Jim Crockett Promotions on different angles. Specifically, I can remember the whole thing with Magnum TA and Nikita Koloff over the United States Heavyweight Championship, and Magnum punched Bob Geigel, which caused him to be suspended or stripped, actually, of the U.S. Heavyweight Championship, which led to that big world-famous Best of Seven series that they had. And for folks of my age who only saw him on vignettes and videos that were sent in and things like that, don't really get the full picture of the long and storied career that the man had.
Yeah, yeah. Good guy, good guy.
If you're a subscriber to The Observer, you'll obviously be able to read a lot more about Bob Geigel in the next week or two, because Dave does a wonderful job putting together those biographical pieces, and I'm sure one is forthcoming on Bob Geigel. There was a lot of information in The Observer this week, Les, about a lot of other things, including this lawsuit that Billy Jack Haynes is filing. They're hoping to get a whole class action lawsuit thing going on that we're going to talk about in just a second. But one other thing I do want to mention is the big story of the last couple of days, which is the WWE Network subscriber numbers. Now, as I mentioned, Dave and Brian did a lot of great coverage on this on the site and an audio show yesterday with Jim Ross, which is absolutely fantastic. Plus, subscriber stuff, the kind of detail that is required for business metrics is much better covered by Dave and Brian than either of us. But there is something that I do want to touch upon just because I just can't let it go. I was tweeting it all day yesterday, and the fact that the subscriber number came out and was announced at 731,000, now that this network is available in over 170 countries and a television deal in Canada, there's no way that number can be construed as anything other than terrible. And the only reason that the stock price didn't tank is because WWE is well-versed in figuring out how to run a lean and mean operation. And they had cut so much less that they managed to avoid, they lost significantly less than their initial corporate guidance suggested. And the fact that they turned a potential $15 to $20 million loss into something that I believe was maybe $5 million or less was enough for Wall Street to see and avoid, you know, tanking the stock. But it still doesn't change the fact that these subscriber numbers are no good. And I think, at least for me, just my opinion, the things they announced in the last day or so about ditching the six-month subscription and saying, well, it's just in step with Netflix and Hulu and the evolution of those respective services, and the WWE Network is kind of modeled around those two. It's just another step in the evolution. To me, it's a sign that of desperation, first of all. And it's also, for me, a sign that they still don't really, for whatever reason, and I'm incredulous at this, I don't think they really see what the real problem is. And if they see it, they won't acknowledge it. To me, the moral of the story on this network number thing is not only is there too much free TV, which I think people in Stanford would even tell you, between the extra hour of Raw, I think has really changed the game, turning it into 3 hours of Raw and 2 hours of SmackDown. And that's going to hold the network number down no matter how good your product is. But it's not just that there's 5 hours of free TV, relatively speaking. It's the fact that these 5 hours are not very good most of the time, Les.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with you 100%. You can give anything away you want, but still, there's got to be a value to it. The adjustments they make aren't it's good. I guess if you're a CPA, you know, if you're a bookkeeper, if you're a financial genius, then obviously the numbers, I mean, the way they're crunching the numbers and changing and you know, backing off on payoffs and this and that and the other thing, it all makes sense, you know. But it, in terms of your talent, it doesn't make, I mean, again, you know, they're in a position, which I guess it's good and it's bad. They're in a position where virtually they're the only game in town. So everybody wants to work for them, and no matter what you're paid, you should keep your mouth shut and go. But that's not good either. I mean, you know, a good work environment is important. And I can't believe that everybody's going out there giving 150%, watching their payoffs drop in half or by a third or whatever. I mean, I'm sure. You're right. I mean, there's not a lot I can elaborate on. You know, it's a lot of free TV, which is not very good a lot of the time. And, you know, and with the network thing, it's here again. I haven't watched it, but I've heard people say, well, they're not doing the shows in sequence. So I'm watching this hot angle and I'm expecting to see the finalization of that or where it's going next. And I don't get to, I see what they're looking at and what they think is of value. But is it going to end up biting them in the butt in the long haul? And like you say, over 170 countries and on TV in Canada, and you're doing this kind of numbers. It's, you know, again, I'm not a number cruncher, and I'll be the first to admit I'm not a financial genius in any way, shape, or form. But you know, it kind of speaks for itself. It's a bad turnout, you know. It's a bad return on your investment. So I don't know where they're going with this, but I'm like you. This is kind of our heads, you know, the ostrich thing. We buried our head in the sand, means nobody can see us. And no matter what the general public or reviewers think of our show, it's our direction.
Right.
You know, we're creating. What are you creating, though? Realize. And again, I'm not old enough to remember vaudeville, but I know the historical significance of vaudeville. It became, you know, it was a traveling show of jugglers and dancers and singers and comedians and this and that and the other thing. But eventually they wore out their welcome. eventually other things took their place. And I don't think the need again. And again, you can take this for what it's worth. You know, you can think, well, the old man is, he's 74 years old and he wants to see the things of bygone days, and I really don't. But I think you've got to back off a little bit, do away with some of the stupid comedy, the bad comedy, you know, doing the same run-in finish or walk-away finish or distraction finish over and over and over again. You have legitimately have to sit down and worry about your product. And I think part of it, Vic, is that this company has expanded to the point where there's so many divisions that you need somebody to the beginning of this was professional wrestling. Call it whatever you like, it's professional wrestling. And that's kind of that's the heart of the thing, the foundation of the thing. And somebody needs to go back there and put their stamp on this thing and say, hey, you know, if we improve the product, then maybe we'll sell more of it. I don't know. You know, again, I'm no financial genius. I'm no corporate leader by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, it's if you're making cars and you're not making them well, you're not, you know, once the product gets out and people start having problems with the cars, you're not going to sell as many. And I think that's the problem here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with so much television already available to you without reaching into your pocket for anything more than your standard cable bill, if you're going to get people to pay an extra $9.99, which is not a whole lot of money to ask, but if you're going to get them to reach into their wallet at all, especially the way the economy had been in recent years, and folks who are still a little reticent, to spend, those extra bucks, then you got to give them something with those 5 hours that makes them actually want to see more. And that's hard enough with 5 hours, but if the TV's not going to be up to par, no one's going to spend $9.99 for more.
Right. Well, you know, it's like you're saying, and they you know, they're sacrificing guys who have potential to be major players or top-tier guys. And listen, when I say major, you know, everybody's not going to be Steve Austin. Everybody's not going to be Hulk Hogan. Everybody's not going to, you know. But everybody can have a value. And you mentioned to me the Ziggler thing where they burned Cesaro at the stake to get Ziggler over because he's in this on Team Cena or something.
Yeah, the Survivor Series main event.
And then tonight, I guess we're going to, spoiler alert, he's going to have his ass handed to him. So you basically have hurt Cesaro to get Ziggler over so Ziggler can put other people over. And so now you've got Cesaro down. You've got, so it means, if you look at it in perspective, if Rollins hands Cesaro his ass and Kane hands Ziggler his ass and Kane hands Ziggler his ass tonight, then the fact that he handed Cesaro his ass, that leaves Cesaro another notch down on the pole, doesn't it?
Right. And then when somebody else beats Cesaro, it really does nothing for them.
Yeah. It's, you know, and you've got to establish some of these guys as mid-carders, and that's the case. But then you've got to start rebuilding your top. You know, I don't want to get into the pay-per-view. I don't want to get into Monday Night Raw. We've got other things to talk about, and our fan listeners, fan base has said that they like listening to us talk about other things. But, you know, it's like the last thing they needed with Ambrose was to run somebody in. Dave feels that Ambrose proved that he wasn't the guy. Well, I don't know if Dean himself proved he wasn't the guy. They proved, you know, they on one hand they want to make him the guy, on the other hand they hinder him from being the guy. I don't think the fans need to wonder, will he end up being Wyatt's partner? Will he end up being beat by Wyatt? And either way, it's, you don't need to be guessing about Dean Ambrose at this point. He needs to be solidified as whoever he is supposed to be. And at this point, I would think, you know, he's that baby face that's a little left of center, and we're never sure what he's going to do. It would have been smarter to get him that win over Seth, because it's easier for the heel to get their heat back in a lot of ways than it is for the baby face. So, you know, that's... But I think that's part of their problem, is the no continuity of storylines, no and they spend, you know, 10,000 hours on something that's not going to draw them a dime, like the Bellas. And I'm sure they're both fine ladies, and I mean, I don't know them personally, so it's not a personal issue. But, and I don't even think they did that right, but that's neither here nor there. I just think they're throwing stuff against the wall and see what sticks. And because of the vast size of this corporation at this point in time, I think they've lost track of what really, where this train started to be built and where the engine is and you know, what where the problem is. I don't know if I'm babbling or just or making some sense, but anyway.
You're doing better than they did this week.
Ah, well. Anyway.
Is that damning you with faint praise?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, let's move on to one of the big stories that was on the, or is in the Observer this week, the Wrestling Observer newsletter that put together brilliantly for many, many years by Dave Meltzer. And that's the lawsuit filed by Billy Jack Haynes up in Portland, Oregon. Basically, in a nutshell, because it's there's a fabulous story on it in the Observer. If you haven't checked it out, please do. But it's more or less modeled after the NFL lawsuit that was recently settled a few months ago, where it was alleged that the National Football League, and this lawsuit was a class action lawsuit brought up against them by former players, with respect to the allegation that the NFL was in fact aware of the dangers of concussions and head injuries and things of that nature, and withheld that information from players. Therefore, those who played in previous generations did not know exactly what they were getting themselves into by stepping onto the football field and putting their body on the line in such a way, because the NFL withheld the information that they had regarding concussions and brain injuries and things of that nature. And ultimately, the NFL was forced to pay out, I believe the judgment was something in the area of $760 million less. And you and I talked about this both on and off the air at the time. And we weren't the only ones. I mean, it was the prevailing opinion that even at that enormous amount, it sounds like a lot, that they skated because it was a drop in the bucket to the NFL, that amount of money. And that really for the amount of people who were involved in that lawsuit, because it goes back to, I believe, the 1960s, that the way it broke down from the amount of the amount of money each person was going to get, the NFL was really actually very fortunate to only be found to have to pay 760 something million bucks that it could have and really should have been a lot more at the time.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Didn't actually leave these guys who had the concussion problems and who were in the problems with dementia and memory loss and one thing and another, it didn't leave them a lot. You're right. I don't remember the exact number. You know, I don't know Billy Jack Haynes. I've never met Billy. But, you know, it's, are there people, you know, I've had this conversation with a couple people this week. There are people in our business who look at the performers, the athletes, the wrestlers, the superstars, call them whatever you will, is just pieces of meat. You know, I mean, when I say that, I mean, it's part of the business. They are the tool that makes, you know, that you use to operate your business, and they don't look at them as human beings. But I think that's, we're not talking about wrestling exclusively here. We're talking about professional sports in general, or professional entertainment in general, where we have money invested in these people, and they have to go. You know, we expect them to go. And, yes, are there people in WWE who understood the concussion problem and didn't care? I'm sure there are. I don't know who those people are. You know, I don't think everybody is heartless and cold to the fact. I mentioned this a couple times this week as well. I know with the Russ Haas thing, for those who don't know Russ Haas, Charlie's brother, passed away when he was here in Cincinnati with me in developmental. But I do know that when JR was, Jim Ross was head of talent relations, that even after the doctors had cleared Russ to go back to the weight room, which he did, we held him out of the ring rather to err on the side of holding him out too long opposed to putting him back too quick. And I've said to somebody this week, I said, I can't even begin to tell you how upset that would have made Jim or myself had we had put him back in the ring and had him have that heart attack there. He had his heart attack on a couch in his apartment. the night before our Christmas party, December the 15th of 2001, I think. 2001. And so everybody's not cold and heartless in this business, which is sound. I mean, you know, the lawsuit makes it sound that way, but there are people. You know, there's times that I was told with injuries, you got to work. We need you to work. You have to work. And there were times that I realized that I could go some, and I did. But there were times I realized I couldn't, and I didn't. You know, so to say, you know, to make it sound like the whole industry is heartless, I don't think so. But I know when Chris Norwinski, who was part of my group here in Cincinnati for a while, started in with these doctors and so forth on the concussion deal after he had had his concussion. I know that there were people in WWE that tried to silence him, you know, or you know, tried to discredit him. And I think, you know, that was an obvious business ploy on somebody's part. I don't know whose. But everybody in the business is not heartless like that. That's, you know, the other thing on this is being forced to take recreational drugs, being forced to take anabolics. I don't, you know, I can't speak for everybody else, but I don't know that to be a fact. I think it's an unspoken fact that if you don't have enough size, or, you know, are not genetically gifted or can't get enough with a natural lifting and proper diet and stuff, that there's one other way to get bigger. But now, are there people in the company that actually come out and say that? There may be. I don't know. Never heard that. I know it was in that article, it was mentioned Lance Cade.
Yeah, that was really the reason I brought this up, because
Lance,
a lot of folks have heard those kind of, you know, those allegations before. But this story regarding Lance Cade was something I had never heard before, and that was that a wrestler, unnamed in this article, pointed out that he felt he knew for a fact that Lance Cade really wanted nothing to do with taking performance-enhancing drugs, but the people in the company kept telling him to get in better shape, and he already knew he was doing everything he could possibly do naturally to get in the kind of shape they wanted him to get into. And so he almost felt like he was forced to do so, and he noted that people who were being called up from developmental, he felt that were using, that weren't as talented as him, as he, were getting the call, and he was stuck down in developmental, and not long after he started using, he got the call.
You know what? Now, is there a connection there? Vic, I don't know. I know that that he and I both were curious as to when, and this is when he was with me, as to why he wasn't getting looked at on call-up for dark matches. And I never got a definitive answer in any way, shape, or form as to why, and never could give him one. Now, did he start on the gas while he was with me? I can't say he did or he didn't. My stance on anabolics, I understand they are illegal. I understand all the above. I also understand that when they first came out and when I was working in the business, they weren't. But I've never used. I've never been involved with anabolics. Personally, I have never used them. My stance has always been with athletes, you know, you are over the age of consent. You are an adult. This is your call, not mine. You know, you got to understand the health issues, the possibility of creating bad health. I understand the possibility of getting larger, you know, and maybe making more money. But, again, this comes back to you. This is not about me. I don't supply them. I don't, you know. But, again, it's a personal issue. And so that's the way, and that's the stance I've always taken. I've also asked the guys, do not bring anything like that into my gym. I do not need help from the federal government running my business. What you do personally at home is your, you know, in private is, you know, unless it affects me legally or in some negative way, is none of my business, truthfully. And that's, you know, now, again, I don't know who agrees or disagrees with that stance, but that's, you know, that is my stance. But I don't think anybody, you know, realize I've been around guys who have used that. I mean, hell, I've been around it in bodybuilding because I've worked with professional bodybuilders who obviously use anabolics. I mean, it'd be hard to disguise that in any way, shape, or form. But that has not enticed me to use. I've said here, too, that I have smoked my share of grass over the years, but I have never been a big user of prescription drugs. I mean, I've used what was prescribed to me and used them the way they prescribed, but I have never, you know, saw there any, you know, reason to get into those for any reason, you know, other than an injury. So to say that the atmosphere, yeah, I can understand, you know, but it's not like something you have, it's your decision. It's not something you have to do. It's not something you've been made to do. And I realize a lot of the guys in the wrestling business don't understand about performance drugs and supplements anyway. I told this story earlier in the week to someone, ephedrine or ephedrine or whatever the hell, however you want to pronounce it, I've heard it both ways, when this was over-the-counter legal, right? Because I trained at 6 a.m., I used to use some of that. Because it helped with my oxygen uptake. And, but I also realized in researching it that, your body could build a tolerance quickly and the prescribed way to use it was, 2 days on and 2 days off so that your body had a chance to clean out and you didn't, build that tolerance and have to use more and more of it, which is the way I utilized it. I remember having lunch with a friend of mine, and if I brought that name up, everyone that listening to us would know who I was talking about, who was actually active in the ring at the time for one of the big two. And we were having lunch or dinner or something, and anyway, talking about, he was asking me about supplements and about my bodybuilding and this and that and the other thing. When he asked about this particular supplement, he said, wow, you got to use so much of it. And I said, no, not really. He said, well, how much do you use? I said, I never take more than two tabs. Really? And I said, yeah, why? He said, well, I use a dozen or more. But that's because he didn't realize his body was building a tolerance. And he just, because he wasn't getting the effect that he needed, he kept adding, you know, to the number. So a lot of it's, just, you know, you're going to use something because somebody else is using it. And not necessarily know how it's being used or the fact that this person may have a, you know, an injury or some medical problem that this particular drug actually enhances for them. That's my biggest problem is guys not knowing what the hell they're doing. You know, and again, I've never used, you know, so I don't know what I'm doing either. But it's... to say that, well, in this environment, I have to use drugs because everybody else is using drugs, I don't see that. That's a cop-out. You make that decision yourself. It's not a decision that's made for you because you see other guys. I mean, you know, because you see people around you smoking cigarettes doesn't necessarily mean you're going to smoke cigarettes. But I do understand the nature of the beast, Vic. And the nature of the beast is this, whether it's a basketball player, baseball player, football player, or a wrestler, or a hockey player, or whoever, to get to that pinnacle of your chosen profession, you have to, you know, always looking for the edge. And I've said this to you before, too, here on this show. If the word got out tomorrow that John Cena was in that great shape because he ate a lot of green M&Ms, there'd be a run on green M&Ms.
Believe it.
You know? So that's part of it, too. So are there bad guys in the wrestling business? Of course there are. Do they promote drug use? I guess some do. You know, but I don't know how far this particular lawsuit will go. I know Billy Jack has a reputation of being a little off the wall about different things. You know, and I read the article that Dave wrote, and I could see where that would be a, you know, or like Dave said, if a lawyer told him that, well, the reason the guy is a little left to center because of this, well, maybe that's true too. I don't know, but I, you know, I've been around guys who've used all this stuff, and I have yet to use any of it. So, it's not a case that is, you know, I think you can use the peer pressure thing, in terms of, you know, if you're 12 years old or 13 or 14 or 15, but I think when you're talking about adults, you know, it comes down to you making a decision on what you need to do. I know people have asked me, would I use them today? I don't know. You know, I never had the need for them during my in-ring career. I never used them as a competitive bodybuilder because as a mass, you know, I was 46 before I did my first bodybuilding show. And to me, the economics didn't play out to spend an amazing amount of money on anabolics to win and risk my health to win a $40, $50 trophy. It just never made a lot of sense to me. I was doing it just, it was a hobby for me anyway. It wasn't like I wanted to be the next Mr. Olympia or something like that. So I don't know. With Lance, nice, you know, he was a nice kid. He worked his ass off. I never had the first problem with him. And yes, I understood his frustration. I had several guys like that, you know, would question, why am I not getting called up? And it was a question that I asked several times. And of course, there was no definitive answer, right? No exact answer to say this or that. Well, you know, we're looking at them. We're going to do this and do that. So, I don't know. I don't have a clue, but I know he was a good young man and he worked his ass off. And I know, he learned to call a match in the ring when he was with me, and I know, I think he picked his game up there, and why he never got looked at before that, I don't know.
Well, that's one of the reasons I found that story so fascinating, at least that aspect of the article that Dave wrote, because if nothing else, and I'm sure nobody ever said that to him, that he had to use anything, but, I mean, the timing is incredibly curious, especially when he thought he was ready, you thought he was ready, you couldn't get a straight answer from anybody. He starts using, and all of a sudden he's on TV.
Yeah, I don't know. And, of course, we've seen guys come up that looked like they might be ready to take a shot at Mr. Olympia, who, as the old adage goes, couldn't slap their ass with both hands.
Yeah.
You know, I think being in shape is important. Let me first say that right here, right now. I think looking like a professional athlete is important in our business. But it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do drugs of any kind. You know, I can show you pictures of me in my early 50s in a competitive bodybuilding shape. Now, would you have mistaken me for Hogan at his steroid best or Warrior? Hell no. You know, but I was in shape, you know, and a lot of these guys don't have the bone structure anyway. And here's the other thing, too. You got to realize heavy on the anabolics is going to take your wind away from you. I had a guy who was a hell of a bench presser come to me, show me a video. He was a big guy, big guy. Did amazing bench presses and stuff. And this guy could do cartwheels and stuff and over 300 pounds. He wanted to wrestle. But my first thing was get off the gas, you know, because you're bench pressing, and nobody's going to ask you to bench press 700 pounds or 600 pounds or whatever the hell it is, you know, and your cardio is going to be bad. You can tend to drop some of this weight because you don't need it, and if you're this agile at this weight, just guess 50 or 60 pounds lighter, how much more agility you're going to have. But his bench press is more important to him. So, you know, but there are downsides to the anabolics, like I say, as well, you know. So and your muscles bellies are going to grow. The problem is your insertions, your tendons aren't. And that's when you see guys blowing out quadriceps or blowing out triceps or blowing out pecs. It's because the insertions where they're hooked, you know, where they're tied in, that's the tendon strength is not going to grow. The muscle size is going to grow. You'll be able to lift heavier, but you're going to put more stress on those tie-ins too.
Let's turn to the questions, because we have quite a few of them this week.
All righty. Let's do this.
In doing so, let's talk a little bit about the match that we all watched last week from the Crockett Cup that you recommended. It was Tully Blanchard, Lex Luger, against the Armstrongs, the Bullet and Brad Armstrong. And there's a couple of – well, first, actually, just go ahead and tell us what it is that you loved about the match, because I know that the reason we ended up talking about it last week and asking anyone who was listening to the show to check it out so we could talk about it this week was because – you'd actually sent that video to a couple of trainers you do work with who own their own wrestling schools as something that they could look at and learn from and teach to their kids.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I find it's hard to explain tag team psychology and how it should be worked. And this was a good example. Now, Lex and Tully are getting the baby faces over strong because they're going to end up winning at the end. But the point is, it's the quick switches. It's how everybody plays off everybody else. JJ was managed to work in the corner. You know, but it's the little things. The little things that make the big things work. The way Brad and Bob kept going back to the arm. The way Tully kept fighting for the corner and would just get so close. Brad and Bob were doing the switches. Now, I know one of the fans at Watch It mentioned, well, the heels have to be over to get that done. Absolutely. Everybody has to be over to get that done. You know, you have to establish who you are to make that work. But that's one of the things, if you watch this match, turn the volume up and listen to the crowd. It was a great story told. The other thing is when, like, the Armstrongs were making the switches without tagging. I mean, they basically what they were doing was turning the tables on the heels, who had done this in the past, obviously, or continued to probably do it throughout this tournament. So Bob and Brad were turning the tables. But it was the body language, the facial expressions, the way the corner men worked, the way, you know, watch Bradley throw his drop kicks. That's one of the most technically sound human beings on the face of God's green earth that I ever saw work in a wrestling ring. But the way Tully, now I know the question was, did I think Tully called a match? I'm guessing he probably did. At this point, Bob would have been fine with that. Now, I won't say that Bob didn't add a spot here or there, possibly, because he would have been the senior member in the group. They also kept Luger's lack of technical skills covered up well because he didn't work that much. But it was the way Tully built to the... And then finally, where the heels pull it out of nowhere, the double clothesline with JJ. But watch the referee. He doesn't keep his back turned for 15 minutes or 3 minutes. Whether it's the heels making the illegal switch or the baby faces making the illegal switch, it's done and done. And they continue working a body part. It's the way they tell the story, the way they build from the foreplay to the climax at the end of the match, which is what made it so beautiful for me.
You answered the first question that we got about that, whether Tully was probably the guy leading the match. But the other question was your thoughts on Lex Luger within the context of this particular match. I think he was still new to the Horsemen at the time and not teasing a turn, but it seemed like he was playing cool heel to the guys chanting for him and being outright babyface in some spots. Probably more forgivable since the crowd knew to pop big for the Armstrongs, but should Luger have not acknowledged the chant and instead tried to turn the people against him a little more?
Yeah, I think so. Again, you know, I'm not there. I'm not the booker. My longtime friend Kevin Sullivan, I'm guessing, probably, no, not at the Crockett Cup. That would have been Dusty.
Dusty,
yeah,
right?
Dusty,
yeah,
right. I'm thinking WCW. Anyway, yeah, that would have been Dusty. But, yeah, the one thing, you know, I keep harping on to young guys now is turn your back on your opponent is the biggest insult you can give to your opponent. It's like saying you are useless, so I don't even have to watch you. I can turn my back and walk away. And I noticed Luger doing that flagrantly, but of course part of that is a lack of experience. Part of that is him acknowledging, yeah, I think he probably overindulged himself with the audience. I do agree. I would have then paid more attention. But then if you realize the baby faces got a lot of support and never turned around and asked for it. Bob worked the corner. You could see, well, you could watch. That was the other thing too, the way they worked the corner, but the way Tully was fighting to get to Luger and fighting to get to Luger, and he just get close, and then they cut him off. And I mean, just the way they built the story, they kept the people in it, and they, you know, and they took it right down to where, you know, damn, but the Armstrongs can win this thing, and then JJ helps him steal it. But then what, you know, watch JJ too. He starts to make a move a couple times, and the spot's not right because people aren't paying it. Like we were talking about last week. If Ken Ramey draws a referee and you're not aware of it, then he's wasted that draw. JJ would start to, I forget the switch situation toward the end where he held the top rope down. he waited to make sure it was the right time to pull that top rope down, so that the Armstrong could take the bump over. He waited at the exact right time, and the referee didn't keep his back turned, because that's the other thing in the current state of the business is these two heels are beating the hell out of babyface behind the referee's back, and he just keeps, you know, never bothers to turn around. And he has to take a guy back to his corner if he's coming in illegally, if that's the illegal babyface. But he doesn't stay there and go to the Gettysburg Address with him, for Christ's sake. You know, it's to take him back there once he gets in that corner, and he should be able to turn back around. But, of course, that babyface that's in illegally is also the referee's eyes, and he can acknowledge to the referee it's okay to turn. They've got the damage done. And there's only one guy in the ring back there. So that, I mean, that's that, and that was the reason that, yeah, I told Antonio and Thomas and Danny Cage and Tony Gibbons and a bunch of the guys that I do camps for, have your people watch this, you know, because it's an explanation. But it is where the babyface is in charge early on. But the reason for that, too, is when Tully and JJ and Lex steal it, they beat somebody. The Armstrongs had them by the short hairs for 70% of this friggin' match. You know, so that's part of the story. Now, we've beaten someone. But obviously, Tully was the ringmaster there, the general, no doubt. And like I say, I'm sure Bob was comfortable with that, because at this point in Tully's career, you know, he had been established as a top heel. So I don't think there was any problem with that. And like I say, Bob may have added something. But it's just a great match to learn from, I think.
Question about concussions, and we kind of inadvertently touched on some of this with respect to cold-hearted promoters and those who would encourage you to take your time and rest up before returning from injury. But back when you were wrestling, Les, the question asked, nobody, not too many people at least, thought about concussions and whether or not if you got injured, you basically sucked it up and you kept working. Does Les know or suspect that he had any concussions and how many he may have had? Did he ever feel like he needed to take time off, was afraid to lose his spot on the card? What would promoters have done back then in the territories if a guy had said he was experiencing headaches, vomiting, the kind of concussion symptoms, and needed a couple weeks off? Would the guy have been buried or kept his spot? What would have happened?
Well, you know, a lot of that, I guess, depends on the promotion, too. I think maybe twice in my career I may have had a mild concussion. When I say that, there was no after effect of headaches and nausea and stuff like that. But I do remember going into the shower a couple of times, wondering at some point the light bulb goes off over my head and think, did we get the finish in right? You know, do we get this done right? Where basically I must have been operating just on automatic pilot, right, opposed to, you know, actually being alert to what we were actually doing. I was just doing it on, you know, on fumes. So, but I've never had those, you know, I don't know. I guess I've been really lucky. Now, as far as promoters taking care of it, you know, I have a real love for this the Charlotte office. Excuse me. One of those reasons would be Jim Crockett Sr. In 1972, I came down with hepatitis. And Jim called, Mr. Crockett, Jim Sr., called me every week. At least once. Hey, baby. And baby was what he called everybody. It was just Jim's expression. How you doing? Well, you know, the doctor said this. Now realize I was going to my doctor every day, going in the back door at his office to get a B12 shot and then go home and lay down and sleep. I mean, I had no energy. It was just, it was hell. I was out for over 6 weeks. But anyway, Mr. Crockett would call and, how you doing? And I always felt an obligation. I mean, this was never any pressure from him, but I always felt an obligation. I'd say, well, Jim, you know, I hope to get back as soon as possible. But his comment to that every time I said that was, don't be in a hurry. We want you healthy. Take care of yourself. And then he would ask, he said, how's the car payment, the rent? Everything's fine, Jim. I got, now every week he sent cash money to me through either Klondike Bill or Big Boy Brown, who both lived in that area. And one or the other would stop by, knock on the door, and hand me an envelope with cash in it. And I'd say, well, no, Mr. Crockett, I got the money. No, that's just groceries, baby. If you need some, if you need a car payment, if you need a rent, you let me know. Now, somebody said, well, did they take that money out of your pay? If they did, it was such a minute quantity. I said, I don't know that. But the week that I came back to work was Thanksgiving week of 1972. And I was not figured into anything at that point in time, obviously, because no one was sure of my return time. And, you know, and so there was nothing built. But I was given, now, there was a lot of Coliseum shows ran, but I was given three of those shows simply for the fact that I had a good week coming back. So if you wonder why I have such respect for Jim Crockett, senior in that office, that would be one of the reasons, because he never put any pressure on me to come back. He never, you know, it was always take care of yourself, get well, and when you're ready, you're ready.
This is an interesting question. Of all the wrestling shirts you've ever seen, Les, from all the different territories and promotions, which one was your favorite? I imagine it had to be the one you had a hand in creating.
I guess so. You know, we probably, Brutes and Associates, which was ownership was Jack and Jerry Briscoe, Thunderbolt Patterson, and myself. I think we did the first T-shirts, and we did Briscoe Boosters and TP Power. And I think I've said that here on the show before. Jerry Lawler did the pen and ink renderings for both those T-shirts. And those would have been 71, 72 in Charlotte. Because I remember hauling them with me and getting an apartment with a second bedroom in Atlanta when I went down to do the TV and work in the office there with Gordon during the war, that I hauled all the T-shirts, hundreds of friggin' T-shirts with me down there, and you know, because we were shipping them out and stuff. But when we first got them, Jerry Briscoe and I took them to the buildings in the Mid-Atlantic area and sold them there. But yeah, those were cool, I think, because they were the first. I mean, and they were nothing fancy. They were black ink, screen printed, and on white T-shirts. You know, it was just that simple. Nothing really fancy about them. So yeah, I'd say that was probably, and I kind of like it. It's not, I read that one T-shirt to you that I made up when I first started HWA, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that would have been one of my favorites too, and I don't have that right in front of me, otherwise I can't read about it. But I like the EPW T-shirt that we have now, that I have, you know, which has the David Allen Co. If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride on the back. I guess probably because I've never been big on really gaudy, crazy T-shirts. You know, I like them a little nicer. But anyway, so, yeah, I guess so. But, you know, there's a lot of cool shirts out there. It's just, I don't even go in WWE Shop Zone, but there must be, what, 100 different designs on there or more?
Oh, easy.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I think probably the Briscoe Boosters and TP Power have been my first favorites because they were the first ones out there.
With respect to the Universal Wrestling Federation, Bill Watts' territory, which he renamed UWF after Mid-South for many years, which wrestlers, in your estimation, should have gotten a bigger push, Les?
You know what? I know that you asked Missy this or somebody, didn't you?
I did, yes.
All
I
right.
checked in with Missy.
I'm going to bow to Missy because she worked that territory, and I never worked that territory. So what did Missy have to say?
Well, Missy checked in to tell me that she felt like, and we weren't really sure about with respect to the question, whether the person asking meant the UWF before or after selling to Crockett Promotions. But, Missy pointed out that there was not a whole lot of great talent left after Crockett had bought the UWF. Guys like DiBiase, Hacksaw Duggan, the One Man Gang, Sam Houston, and all left for WWE. By that point in time, Japan was the primary stomping grounds for Steve Williams and Terry Gordy. So when they came in, there wasn't much you could do with them because they couldn't lose,
right,
based on their deals in Japan. Michael Hayes was pretty much doing the TV announcing at that point with Jim Ross, so there wasn't a whole lot for him as far as wrestling is concerned. Terry Taylor was not, for whatever reason, at that point in time, held in particularly high esteem by Dusty Rhodes. Eddie Gilbert was definitely a fresh character, but basically the only guys who really end up spending some quality time there after the buyout was Eddie, Rick Steiner, Sting, and Shane Douglas, all of whom were just guys who had potential at that point in time, but were still in their formative years, speaking of Steiner, Sting, and Shane Douglas. And obviously Steiner and Sting made it big. Shane Douglas ended up moving into the whole Dynamic Dudes thing and then was a partner with Ricky Steamboat and had some success as a tag team guy, but obviously went on to greater success and much more name value in ECW.
Who did she think before the Crockett buyout?
You know what? That was the thing. You know, but by the time that was part of the thing that almost kind of forced the buyout, because, you know, all the problem with his territory, as Dave has talked about a number of times, was that once they made the move to the Universal Wrestling Federation and tried to compete, Jim Ross went out there and aggressively got the whole syndication network thing going. But at that time, you had to follow the Vince model, which means you were paying to have your television on there.
Right.
And prior years, you know, that was a trade or a barter kind of thing where the promotion
and the oil industry took a hit too.
Exactly. Watts's territory, the key cities in his territories were hit by that oil.
Yeah.
The oil issue, and they obviously, the economy dried up in those places, and therefore attendance was down, not because of a lack of interest in the product, but people simply couldn't afford those extra things like going out to have a little extra fun and going seeing wrestling on a Saturday night. So Watts lost a lot of money because the houses were way down as a result of the whole oil issue, and they were paying inordinate amounts of cash to keep that syndication network going. Therefore, they had to sell.
Yeah.
And when those money problems hit, a lot of those guys took off.
The reason I said I'll bow to Missy is, you know, I never worked the territory. I wasn't working there at that time. But it seemed to me that everybody that Bill used before the buyout, you know, were the guys that I would have pushed as well. So that's why I was saying, you know, that she was being in the midst of that, she would have a better feel for it than I would.
We're not going to talk too much about Hell in a Cell, but there are two Hell in a Cell related questions here, Les.
Okay.
What do you think about people kicking out of finishers now in every match, like at Hell in a Cell? And I believe the question actually refers to the John Cena-Randy Orton match, where each of them kicked out of, I think it was two RKOs, and it wasn't until the third attitude adjustment through a table that John Cena won the match. And even Brian said earlier this week that he was enjoying that Orton-Cena match until, I think it was John Cena kicking out of one of those, the second RKO, and Brian used the phrase, the match went from being really good to kind of indie for me after that.
Yeah. Well, see, that's gotten to be, and it's not just WWE, it's across the board. This is, you know, I don't have a problem with somebody kicking out of a cover or something, but when you start kicking out of guys' finishes, then it takes away any esteem on that particular finish. And when, you know, especially when you see two guys go out and they use not only each of their finishes, but everybody else's as well. You know, it creates a problem for any believability at some point. And it takes away, well, you know, it comes down to if you and I stand and exchange 20 chops apiece, somebody can say, well, you know, boy, that Vic and Les, are they tough? No, they say their chops aren't terribly effective, are they? You know, or their punches, or if you kick a guy, you know, 20 times and he doesn't register, it doesn't mean he's, you know, again, your job here is to suspend people's disbelief, and that's not the way to do it. It's just not. So I'm not an advocate of kicking out of everybody's finisher. I'm an advocate of not, you know, if I'm putting these two guys together, why not make it a little more interesting? Have John go for his finish and Randy be able to block it, and have Randy go for his and John be able to block it, and have the announcers actually get into the match and the story and say, these guys have wrestled each other umpty-ump number. You know, it's like the build for this weekend of Peyton Manning versus Tom Brady. Right, Brady they've met 15 times, and Brady has won 10 of those 15. And so that's the story, is that these guys, you know each other so well. And, you know, especially Belichick with Peyton, you know, because Peyton's with a different team now. But so that would be my story with Randy and John, is not that, wow, he kicked out of his finisher three times, which must make him more of a Superman than we made him to begin with. But that Randy can't seem to hook us because John, you know, sees it coming. John has been there, and Randy sees John's coming. And so they have to go to a different finisher. I remember, and I've said this to you before, I think, I remember going on a PR junket with Lou Thesz down in Georgia back during the war. And one of the radio people or TV people, I forget which it was, doesn't matter, said to Lou about his one finishing move or hold or whatever he called it. And Lou said, I don't have just one. He said, show me somebody with one way to win a match, and I can show you a guy I can beat every time. So the cool thing would have been whoever's going to win this damn match is if they were able to pull it out in some way other than their finisher, because they've wrestled the other guy so many times that he has their number on that and is able to counter it or block it. Make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Call the right.
The other Hell in a Cell.
Explain that to them.
Good luck.
Yeah, really.
The other Hell in a Cell related question is regarding the 2 out of 3 fall match between Ziggler and Cesaro, won by Ziggler in straight falls, as a matter of fact. And not about that specifically, but about the whole 2 out of 3 fall concept. I'd like to hear Les's opinion as a booker on what makes a good 2 out of 3 fall match.
The two workers. I'm being a smart aleck, aren't I? Well, you know that. I mean, it's important who the two guys are, you know, to how good the match is going to be. But, you know, it all comes up to whether it's one fall or three. It's about the storyline. It's about how we got here and where we're going from here. You know, there are times that you need to put somebody over too straight. But I think some of the best 2 out of 3 fall matches you will ever see is if you can go back and watch some of the old NWA world champions, work with guys, the local territory's top babyface or top heel for that matter, and see how they handle it. I can give you a quick example because I remember watching the match when Dory was the champion. He came to Knoxville and he worked with Whitey Caldwell, my former my tag team partner. But now, Whitey wasn't a big guy. Whitey never, except for a couple quick shots here and there, never worked outside of the Knoxville territory, honestly. I mean, the Tri-Cities, Kevin, Kingsport, John City, but East Tennessee is pretty much where Whitey worked. So it wasn't like he was an international star. But they went 3 falls. And when Dory finally won the match, they didn't go quite an hour, I forget exactly the time, but by when Dory finally got his hand held up at the end of that third fall, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that Whitey was just that close to being the world champion. So it comes down to the two guys doing the work is what it comes down to, is to making it believable. You know, and when I started the business, every match was 2 out of 3 falls. So it was... but it was, you change it up. So there's no particular formula that I can think. I mean, there are, like I say, there are times that you expect a guy to win too straight. And he should. I wouldn't have thought that was Ziggler and Cesaro. But, hey, what do I know?
Well, you just mentioned about every match back in the day being 2 out of 3 falls. And obviously that changed during the course of your career. So how did that change your match preparation or maybe the way you paced yourself in a contest?
Well, you know, if you're going 3 falls, you obviously had 3 finishes. And so that made a difference in how you built the match, obviously. You know, you weren't going to kick out of everybody else's finisher in the first fall. But yeah, well, part of the change was, I think, to speed things up, to expedite things quicker. Today with 2 out of 3 falls, I don't know. You know, there's could be a reason for that. But with WWE, they're so lukewarm when it comes to establishing a reason for anything. Can you give me a legitimate reason why Cesaro and Ziggler went 2 out of 3 falls?
Hell no.
They can't either, probably. It's just somebody said, we need a stipulation. Okay, how about 2 out of 3 falls? Okay, why? I don't know why, but let's do it. That's my problem is that it's There should be a reason for everything that you do. And if there is not a reason, then there is no reason to do it. You know, it goes back to us talking about that tag match with, you know, with Blanchard and Luger against the Armstrongs. There was no wasted effort in that match. Everything built to the finish. Everything was part of telling the story. There was no wasted effort.
I don't know how much discussion it warrants, but I've always been intrigued by sets of brothers where one is a star and the other is neither acknowledged nor pushed, such as Cowboy Bob Orton and his brother, who you may not, or those listening may not have been aware of, was known as Barry O in the WWF back in the day. Randy Savage and Lanny Poffo, and Jake Roberts and Sam Houston. I guess the question I'll ask off of this submission, Les, is were you aware of maybe sets of brothers that you worked with in territories where that was the case? One was pushed and one wasn't, or wasn't even acknowledged on television?
Well, no, not really. Those are probably the best examples right there. The Kernodals, you know, Don got the big push with Sergeant Slaughter, where, you know, he and his brother got a semi-decent push. But no, those are the best examples. I can't give you anything better than that.
That's true. And Don's brother,
you know,
for a while,
we were talking
was not
about
known.
The stars earlier. Ricky Starr was a major player. Mark Starr was a preliminary wrestler. I had never met Ricky. I knew Mark. You know, good guy. I don't know. Did it affect Mark? Did he feel slighted? I don't know. There was never anything that ever came up in our conversation to that effect. It was just, this is Ricky Starr's brother, Mark. Okay, hi, Mark. How are you? You know, I think for a lot of the boys, you accepted guys for who they were, what they, you know. I mean, and when I say who they were, I mean how they treated you, obviously, but also for their talent. You know, there were a lot of great workers during my era that were never pushed as major players. You know, we've had this conversation before, too. A lot of those guys, the best example I can give you is what Leo Garibaldi said to me, half in jest, but there was a lot of truth to it as well. He said, I remember the first time he ever said to me, kid, you're a hell of a worker. Thank you, Leo. Well, that's the good news. The bad news is you're going to do a lot of jobs because there's some guys in our business that aren't great workers. And you know, so there's a lot of truth to that, too. So it's not necessarily that one's getting the push because he's more talented than the other. It's just he happens to be in the right place at the right time or has the right look or, you know, it comes down to our business. Obviously, a lot of it's, you know, in the mind of the eye of the beholder.
Right.
More so than it is about the guy's actual talent.
Now, our friend Alice Radley, who we've already mentioned a little earlier, who takes great care of Jimmy Cornette's podcast on the MLW radio website. We already talked about the Nick shirt, but she mentioned to me something the other day that I was fascinated by, so I got to ask you myself. She told me the other day that she heard you were once on an episode of the very famous game show from back in the day, To Tell the Truth. Now, is this true or false?
That is true. And it still plays occasionally, from what I understand. I know Bobby Simmons has told me a couple of times. He's seen it on reruns. Yeah.
You're kidding.
No, I was on there. I think that was in, I'm going to say 2001 or two.
Okay.
Yeah, they flew me out and to LAX and went to Burbank, and I forget the hotel where I stayed. Yeah, I was the real Les Thatcher, and there were two false, phony Les Thatchers. But I took, besides the one I wore myself, I took a couple HWA t-shirts out for these guys to wear. And, but we didn't fool anybody. Well, I guess we might have fooled somebody. We didn't fool the panelists. excuse me. You remember the show Designing Women?
I do.
Okay. The black guy, I can't think of his name, that was on there, the comedian.
Meshach Taylor.
Yes, okay. He was on the panel at To Tell the Truth. And of course, I got in there on, you know, the day before, we did the show, and they schooled us. And one of the things they told you are not allowed to lie. In other words, if they ask you a question, you actually know the answer, then you have to give them the answer. You can stop and think about it, pretend, you know, like, you're struggling with the question, but you have to be honest. So the first question he asked one of the fake Les Thatchers was, what's the real name of Dick the Bruiser? And I thought, Jesus Christ, he is a wrestling fan. You know, because if he'd asked me that, I would have to tell him Richard Aphelous.
Right.
But he didn't ask me. He asked one of the other guys. But anyway, the panel, they finally, everyone, all four of them chose me. And so would the real Les Thatcher please stand up? And I did. So I didn't win any money. It was a nice trip, and I had a lot of fun with it. Yeah, it's still, I guess it still airs. If that show still airs on the Game Show Channel, or I know, like I say, Bobby Simmons told me over the years he's seen it a couple times in reruns somewhere. So, yes, I was on there.
I will have to do some internet searching later today, see what I can come up with. All right, I think, does that cover all our questions? Yeah, I think, oh, no, wait, there is one more. There is one more question, and it's about the WWE Network, so I'm sure it's your favorite subject. With WWE gaining 286,000 but losing 255,000 subscribers in the same quarter, is the WWE Network a sustainable model for their future, or should they abandon ship and go back to traditional pay-per-view less?
You know, I'm honestly not, I don't find myself, don't consider myself smart enough to have a ironclad answer to that. I think they're still trying to tweak this thing. I can see the value, but then, you know, it's, I'd need somebody that's smarter than me with finances to say that you're losing this many pay-per-view buys by selling this network. I don't know. You know, I think that still needs to be determined. Again, I just think that, you know, the root of WWE is professional wrestling. Whether they call it that or they don't call it that is not even the point. And I think they need to make that. Well, you know, and some, again, I haven't seen the network, but I know some of the shows that they put on there, like Legends House, and they were talking about doing a Big Show cooking show. Have they done that?
They have not.
Okay. You know, some of that, I see the value in some of it, and in some of it I'm thinking, really, you know, you have to, they, if I were doing this, okay, and I'm not, obviously, I would have to have some shows that mirrored, mainstream stuff to some certain degree. I would think the roundtable stuff would be, relative in terms of a lot of the older guys, you know, a lot of stories, with video clips and stuff. I'm still waiting for Mike Johnson to send me a copy of the damn Shield special so I can see how nasty I look on there, what I even was involved. I haven't seen it. But, you know, I think if to me, like with the old matches, it's not so much the old matches, but if you had some of these guys that did wraparounds to go with that, right? You know, in other words, going back in time, like a Football Life on the NFL Network, right?
Yeah.
You know, where you have Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels or Steve Austin or even going further back, Tito, you know, Santana or whoever. Sit down, or Austin, you know, sit down and say, you know, going into this thing, I thought this and I thought that, but man, you know, with some insight, you know, I think to me that would interest me. I like that Football Life thing. I think that's a good show. And as you've heard me say over and over again, I think, you know, given profiles of people and in depth about their background over and above their football career or their wrestling career, creates interest in that particular person as well. And, why not feature some of, you know, you've got all these guys in developmental. Why not make their back? I mean, you don't have to put them over on Raw. You don't even have to put them on Raw. If you've got this network thing, why not do some background on these guys? You know, why not find out where they came from, who they are, what their background is, who they, you know, give us some insight into the operation. That's my biggest problem, I think, across the board, is there's no in-depth studies. There's no personality profiles. It's hey, we got all this old stuff. We're going to keep running over and over again. Okay. And I see there's a value to that, but it's like I'm a big the wife and I are big NCIS fans, right? But you know, and USA runs, all, but when I now it's come to the point where if there's nothing else on and I kick on USA because I see NCIS is on, the minute I see that I've recognized that show and I've seen it more than once, I probably find something else. You know, so I think you know, with just a rerunning of the old stuff, you do limit yourself. I think you need to turn out some new programming. And I think, like I was saying, using some of the older guys, bringing them back and having them tape wraparounds to talk about the matches you're about to see.
And then the home stretch of this edition of Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly. So now's a good time for me to tell you once again, if you are checking out this show for the first time, thank you so much for checking us out. This show is a special Halloween treat, absolutely free today to those who are not regular subscribers to the website. Don't miss out, as Doc Young informed us near the start of the show. It's a great value. You get not only this podcast each and every week, but 12 to 15 different radio shows. You also get access to the archives. There's thousands of hours of archived podcasts/radio shows, whichever you prefer to call them, going all the way back to 2005, featuring Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez. Your subscription also is going to land you the Wrestling Observer newsletter and Figure Four Weekly newsletters, and the archives of those go back into the hundreds as well. So there's plenty of material, both reading and listening, for you on this website from the past, as well as the current Observers, the current Figure Four Weeklies, the current radio shows/podcasts. And it's all for the paltry sum of, I don't even want to say it because, you know, WWE's run with it, but it's $9.99.
I know.
How could you go wrong?
I cringe when I hear that too. And we try to cover, oh, you know what you haven't said yet?
What's that?
You haven't said who won pay-per-view prediction game.
Oh, it was a Broadway this month.
Oh, we went to it. For those who don't know a Broadway, Vic's throwing out some old, that's an expression for going to a draw.
Yeah, we were both 5-3 this month.
Okay.
We had, let me see, what was the one? We purposely picked a couple of matches differently,
right,
to make sure that we're not all in alignment. And the way they worked out, they actually canceled each other out, which is why we ended up both 5-3.
All right, so we went to a draw, man, or Broadway. That's cool. That's
we
Doc,
did indeed.
Doc has always kicked my ass. At least you give me some hope that there's a chance I might win some.
The match is much more intriguing when someone has hope.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
So I don't know whether what's on your schedule for this weekend or the coming weeks.
Well, next weekend
I am going to do
my first work in the Cincinnati area in years. I've worked out a deal. There's a group, Christian Wrestling Association International, run by a nice couple based in Hamilton, Ohio. And they have a warehouse where they do a thing called Warehouse Wars. And so I am going to do next Saturday, the 8th of November, I am doing an all-day seminar there starting at 9 a.m. We'll go to 5 p.m. Lunch will be served between noon and 1. Bottled water will be available. It's $50 for the whole day. Anyway, and then Alice and I are going down to North Carolina for the Thanksgiving and stuff. And then when I come back, I hope to start doing 3 sessions a week in there. But it's posted on the front page of EPWT. It mentions the 15th, but it is the 8th. And so anyway, we're in Hamilton, Ohio at the CWAI warehouse, and that's at 1930 Fairgrove Avenue, right across the street from the Butler County Fairgrounds, which is also Fairgrove Avenue, is Route 4. Anyway, if you'd like to join us, you can call Jay at 513-203-6729, or you can call RJ at 513-498-3622 to sign up. And I'm looking forward to it. I, like I say, haven't done anything here in years. And so it's, you know, hope to do something and get something cooking. I've talked to several of the guys, kids, wrestlers I work with around the country, and some of them are planning on, you know, coming in to stay 2 or 3 days. That's a possibility as well. I say we're planning on doing three sessions a week, but RJ and his wife own this warehouse, so it's, you know, available to us 24/7 if we indeed want to use it that way. So if you'd like to come in, two or three, four guys come in for two or three days. I've had guys do that in the past when I was still able, you know, using the HWA arena. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I really am. I don't know what's going on the local scene. I haven't seen any, you know, so it's all going to be fresh and new to me too.
Well, it sounds like a really interesting endeavor. I like that.
I hope so. Good Lord willing, and the creeks don't rise, you and I will hook up here next week, right?
We absolutely will. Now, today being Halloween, I do have one last question, because you've often talked about when you're making yourself available for bookings that you are willing to haunt houses. And so I was just curious if anyone took you up on that today.
Well, nobody has, no.
Oh, okay.
And if you're interested, I am taking, you know, bookings for daily, day-long seminars or weekend training camps, however you want to do it. You reach me, Les@epwt.com or LesThatcher@zoomtown.com.
Will a late email get you to haunt a house today?
Do what?
If someone sends in a late email or phone call now and says, can you be here at 5:30?
If it's not too far away, I can handle that, yes.
All right, so if you're in the Cincinnati area, there you go. I want actual video evidence of Les Thatcher haunting houses, by the way. So that is going to wrap up this giant-sized edition of Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly, which featured a run-in from the doctor himself. So for Doc Young, the legend Les Thatcher, my name is Victor Sosa. Thank you so much for checking out this edition of Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly.